Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you very much for joining us. Our guests are Daisha Eaton of KSKA, Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch, and joining us from Washington, D.C., Peter Granitz of APRN. Daisha, Superintendent of Schools James Browder announces his departure. He was an Anchorage Superintendent of Schools for less than a year and was looking for a job in Omaha, he said, to be closer to home. His community took his decision took the entire community by surprise. What happened?
Well, I believe it was Des Moines, and what happened exactly isn't clear. He says that some family members are ill in Georgia, and he wants to be closer to them, so he applied for this job in Des Moines, and we just found out Friday that he didn't get that job. The local candidate got that job. Whether he'll continue the process of leaving the district or stick around a little bit longer, it's hard to say. But he's supposed to give 4 months' notice, so we'll see what happens over the next few months.
This story doesn't, in some respects, make a lot of sense. It just came out of nowhere, and he said he wanted to be closer to his family, which in Georgia, but he was looking for a job in Des Moines, which would get him, I don't know, two-thirds of the way there or something like that. And it just came out of nowhere. And he's here less than a year.
Yeah, he was here about 8 months, and since he's been here, he's been pretty much cutting the budget and on this austerity plan for the Anchorage School District. As you can imagine, that hasn't made him particularly popular with a lot of teachers and administrators in the district. But he's doing the job that the school board hired him to do, and maybe it's proving tougher than he thought it would. Maybe it's difficult being so far away from his family, more difficult than he imagined. Who knows? And we'll probably see over the coming weeks.
This isn't unprecedented. That corporate executives all over the United States find that a certain job is not for them. And here in Alaska, it's very common for people to decide Alaska is not for them. But it was pretty unusual the way it unfolded. Is there a legacy for Mr. Browder?
Well, he cut the budget by the amount that they asked him to, $25 million or so. The school board is looking right now at what's going to happen if he does indeed give his resignation. He has not given an official resignation at this time. If he does, they're getting prepared to hire somebody else.
Okay, thank you very much. Jill, for the first time in quite a while, we have a media war. Channel 2 versus GCI, and it's not just Channel 2 here in Anchorage. There are a variety of stations all over Alaska who are unhappy about the possibility that GCI would be entering the media market as a television station, or with a television station.
Right. I think this sums up to just basically a good old-fashioned turf war in its very initial stages. So one of the big concerns with Channel 2, KTU, and the other media opponents to this acquisition of three television licenses by GCI is the fact that GCI is kind of crossing platforms. It's a cable giant, it's a broadband giant in the state, so it basically controls the platforms by which content is delivered into your home, either on your internet or on your television set. And KTU and the other complainants are saying, look, this is a huge problem because there's a potential here for abuse. GCI has the potential to squeeze out the competition and to not only now have a monopoly on the pipeline that distributes content, but also on the content itself. And not only is that bad for us, the competitors, but that's bad for the public in general. GCI would counter and say, look, they're just afraid of a little good old-fashioned competition. We intend to build a better news product. We want a news product that is meeting underserved markets, maybe more statewide news, maybe more relevant to rural Alaskans. So the fight currently is at the FCC. GCI needs approval from the FCC before it can acquire the license of the CBS affiliate KTVA here in Anchorage, and then two NBC affiliates in Juneau and Sitka, respectively.
And that explains why there have been objections from Southeast Alaska. Those weren't obvious at first.
Right, and one of the concerns is that not only allegedly has GCI executives or have GCI executives been quite open in some of their discussions with either other media entities or prospective employees, that they do plan to utilize their power and position to minimize the ability of the competition on its cable channels, either through less less prominent position, or maybe forcing really low retransmission rates that it will pay to, say, someone like KTU or other news organizations to put their desired content on their cable.
If I might, I saw the assertions from people who said this, but I didn't understand, why would GCI or their executives say this in any environment where people could get a hold of it?
I don't know. I mean, maybe they don't think it's that big of a deal. Maybe they think it's a business war, and it's the marketplace, and that ultimately the best product will determine who gets what. We asked GCI about that. They told us, look, viewers, consumers are still going to be free to decide what they want to watch and where they seek it out to go find it. And if we're not providing to them what they want, whether it's our own exceptional news product or other content that we provide to them, they're not going to be our customers. And in the long run, it's not good for us.
So, and are we any closer to knowing what Channel 11 GCI has in mind for a roadmap to television success?
Well, we know that they have hired, the GCI has hired as its consultant, longtime former television newsman John Tracy, who was the news director for Channel 2 and an anchor for a long, long time. He's since gone on to be a co-owner at a prominent advertising agency in town. And they've hired John as kind of the go-to guy, whom they call the Walter Cronkite of Alaska, to kind of assemble the A-team, right? To put in the operations into effect, to help build the studio, to find the right like on-air talent and make it all happen. That has not come without taint, because some of the detractors have said, aha, this is proof positive that GCI has its own agenda, and it's not good to have an ad man also now be your journalism guy. So it's getting a little dirty. But the long story short, FCC will need to make a decision whether it's going to get involved. GCI gets to respond to the complaints. And it could take months, six
months,
maybe
longer. And in
the
Alaska media environment, everybody knows one another.
Oh,
we
yeah,
all know
it's a
John
small
Tracy.
Pond,
we all know
small, yeah. So it's getting kind of personal, but it's also very much a business war.
Okay, thank you. Peter, let's turn to you. Senator Lisa Murkowski has questions for and about Sally Jewell, President Obama's choice to be the new Secretary of the Interior. Tell us something about this and the media storm, or media flare storm, I guess, that was set off by the possibility that Murkowski might follow Rand Paul with some kind of filibuster against Jewell.
It all came to the fore yesterday, or Thursday morning, when Sally Jewell, who's the CEO of REI, she's a former banker. She did a lot of banking for the Nana Corporation. She also worked earlier in her career in the petroleum industry as a ranch hand. She said at the hearing that she's actually fracked her own wells. She testified before the Interior Committee yesterday, and from the outset, Senator Murkowski said she's not going to make this spat over the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge and a road through it the center point of the hearing. Senator Murkowski has threatened to hold the nominee, which is effectively a filibuster. Any senator has the right to do this to prevent a final vote on somebody or any piece of legislation in the Senate. She said she's going to do that because she disagrees with the ruling from the Fish and Wildlife Service at Interior from last month that says, no, we will not permit a road from King Cove to Cold Bay, Alaska. People out there have been asking for this road for decades. And Secretary Salazar said no, and she says she wants to see that overturned. And if it's not overturned, she's threatening to filibuster this nomination.
And what is the next step here, or is there one in the murky world of Washington that you can see?
Well, anybody can threaten a hold, Michael, and I think that's key. Any senator can say they're going to do something. It's whether they actually do it is when the story begins. There is no hold yet. There is no filibuster yet. Before she gets to the Senate floor for a full Senate confirmation vote, she needs to pass the Energy and Natural Resources Committee. There's no vote scheduled as of yet.
Okay. Thank you, Peter. Jill, let's go to one of our favorite topics here in Alaska. It absorbs Alaskans every March, the Iditarod. Right. What is the update as of Friday?
So we are in the thick of it as of Friday. We're about at the halfway point. Mushers have come into and gone out of Anvik. And in fact, Allie Zirkle, as of Friday morning, had made it all the way to Grayling. And we have this really pitched battle now for prominence at the top of the race. Martin Boozer, who's a four-time former Iditarod champion and a former speed holder record until John Baker shattered it in 2011, is an early front runner by making this bold and some people called really crazy move at the beginning of the race to run all the way from Willow into Rhone, about 160 miles into the race, almost nonstop. I think he got 2 hours of sleep, maybe a little bit more. So the big question was, could he make that lead hold? He's tried things like that before and his team bonked. You know, it ran too much in the heat, it got too tired, they got ill, their feet got bad. And it was a mistake. But he's calling this team his rocket ship. He got to take the pick.
And he has won four times, I believe.
He has, and he got to take the pick of his kennel. Analysts are saying this is yet another year when the race winners are on track to finish under 9 days. That's only happened, I believe, four times in the history of the race. Baker, Dallas Seavey, Remy Smith, and Lance Mackey. That's pretty incredible when you think about how long this race has gone on and how many mushers have attempted it. You also have mushers who are dealing with these incredibly kind of crazy weather conditions, much, much warmer than they're normally used to, which is hard on the dogs. The dogs like to race at sub-zero, 0 degree, 10 degree temperatures. Anything more than that, they get hot, they need more breaks, they need more water, they slow down, the snow conditions get more grueling. We know that they've had to travel through some overflow earlier this week.
Which can be hard on their feet, too.
Yeah, it's hard on everything, you know, it's just a mess. So up front with Boozer is last year's runner-up, Allie Zirkle, and then also Aaron Burmeister, Jake Berkowitz, and Nicholas Pettit, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, out of Girdwood. And so, you know, the race always kind of evolves in thirds. You know, the first third, you kind of, people shake it out. Next third, by the time you get to Unalakleet, you really know who your top teams are going to be. But right now, it looks like Boozer is on track to kind of maybe pull off this crazy
adventure.
And he had 14
adventure. Dogs, which is the same number that Zirkle had. I noticed
he
that.
He did, yes. And he also got to take the pick of his kennel. You know, Zirkle and Alan Moore, I believe, are both running. I may have that incorrect, but Boozer's son, Roan, was going to run, and he didn't at the last minute. So Boozer got to take the best of the best out of his kennel, and he's really impressed with his team of dogs right now.
Okay, and we'll, by next week, we'll have all the answers
yes.
in the Iditarod department. Peter Granitz, let's go back to you. This wouldn't be a Alaska Edition or a national news show or an Alaska news show without the sequester. And it's starting to have some effects here in Alaska, but hasn't been quite the train wreck that people anticipated months ago. Where are we?
It wouldn't be a show, any kind of show, without mentioning the sequester. Well, on Friday, we saw that the government added more jobs than expected. The unemployment rate went down to 7.7%. And the stock market has gone incredibly higher since the sequester went into effect a week ago Friday. It happened last Friday. The president signed it into law effective 8 o'clock p.m. last Friday. And these $85 billion in cuts have started to be in place, or however it may happen. They'll be phased in over time. In terms of layoffs, we're starting to get some clear direction from the Office of Management and Budget saying which departments need to lay off what. In Alaska, it's looking like the up to 5,000 civilian employees of the Department of Defense may face some kind of furloughs. I'm not exactly certain how many days. The general assumption is that it's going to be once a week for the final 22 weeks of the fiscal year. That's 20% of your paycheck. You're losing 1 day a week to work. That adds up. You notice that after the first of the year when people lost 2% of their paychecks because of an increase in their taxes there, they notice that. They're definitely going to notice 20% pay cuts. It looks like this is here to stay through the fiscal year, which ends September 30th, in which case the Congress right now is working to put together what's known as a continuing resolution. That's Washington speak for the bill that funds the government. They're incorporating that in. It looks like they want to give a little flexibility to the Department of Defense in Veterans Affairs and give the agencies a little more working room with how to implement these cuts, but they're in place and they're not going anywhere. And this was expected and now it's here to stay. And maybe next year we'll get some kind of regular order and some appropriations bills. You know, last week was a total waste of time. both the House and the Senate, you know, put forward these show bills about, you know, replacing the sequester that had no chance of going forward. An interesting story with that, though, of the Democrats in the Senate who are up for re-election in very red states, and I would consider Alaska one of those, three of the four voted against the Democratic plan. They said, we don't want to do this, but that one person, that one Democrat who voted with his party to vote on his party's sequester replacement was Mark Begich, showing that he's not afraid to say he's a Democrat.
I'm sort of wondering that the public, how they sort this out, because it looks like our stock market is functioning very well. The job market is coming back. And what's dysfunctional, once again, is the Congress of the United States.
And it should be noted that they're off today. But it's crazy. You know, people, the polls show that outside Washington, people don't fully understand what the sequester is. I don't wholly believe those polls. I think people do pay a lot of attention, and people do understand that, you know, the government needs to cut its spending. You know, for all of its ills, you know, it's not hard to find people who say that, you know, there is something good to get come out of sequester, and it's the fact that we're starting to put a dent into federal spending. And that could be a reason that, you know, businesses are hiring more, because there's a little more certainty in the economy that the government's getting itself back onto an appropriate track. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but it's not hard to find those people.
So from a certain perspective in Washington, they'd be able to say, this is working. This is, we're going to get a better country out of this. Let's get Daisha in here.
Well, already here in Anchorage, the municipality is looking at, in many different parts of it, the police department, the school district are looking at how cuts in federal spending are going to impact them. Pretty clearly, it's going to impact the People Mover bus system. A lot of their budget comes from federal grants, and they're basically looking at kind of everything's going to freeze with the People Mover bus system. They're going to keep on running the buses, but they're not going to be able to do any projects or improvements, you know, bus stops, maintenance, that sort of stuff. Also, Anchorage Police Department, DWI and seatbelt patrols, it looks like those are going to be hit. Probably internet crimes against children. So, also, task forces on human trafficking and illegal drugs, those could be impacted. Partnerships with the FBI. And then the school district, they already cut about $6 million out of their budget, thinking ahead, realizing that sequester would impact them. They're good for this year, but they're preparing as well. The big thing they're watching is enrollment, because if the Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson gets hit and the families start to leave, that will impact the enrollment and could seriously impact their budget.
Okay, we should note that there are agencies and organizations, federal agencies here in Alaska, all over the country, that are having meetings to discuss what they're going to do about the sequester, how it's going to affect them, when it's going to affect them, if people might go home, if they aren't going to go home, all those kinds of things. And so beneath the surface, there's a lot going on. Daisha, the smoke has cleared, the dust has settled. Title 21 is the law. You have covered this issue. We've discussed it before, but Now that we have some clarity here, where are we on the master planning document for the city of community of Anchorage?
Well, the Anchorage Assembly passed a final version of Title 21.
Land use and standards.
Land use standards for Anchorage. It's a huge document, like almost 800 pages. But the highlights are that they did not require commercial design standards. That's kind of the big thing that everybody's been talking about. That's really not anything much different than, it's not much different than the way it was. So the only thing that they're requiring, the only standard they are requiring is for big box stores. And that's pretty much the way it was. So nothing much changed there. Bottom line is that it still needs a lot more work. They didn't get a lot done that they needed to get done. If they really want to accommodate growth and think about the future of Anchorage, they're going to have to do even more revisions, even though they passed this over the next few years. And they're going to continue to go back to it. One of the things they're going to go back to is 25-foot setbacks for streams, from streams when building. They're going to be analyzing this over the next 6 months. There was a big argument during testimony. Should it be 50 feet? Should it be 25 feet? Should it be 100 feet? Everybody had a different answer according to what they wanted.
Are these going to be planners within the bureaucracy, or are these going to be assembly members who are going to?
These are planners. They're going to review kind of what's the standard around the country, what's the standard in the state, what do environmental studies say, and then they're going to come back with a recommendation to the assembly. and they'll either adopt it or adjust it. So we'll see how that goes. Also, lighting standards, they reserved that. They really didn't make a lot of changes to lighting standards. They know they're going to need to. They're waiting for some national standards to come down and compare and see what they would like to do.
And what do you mean by, in this context, by lighting standards?
Like if you're out on a road on the hillside, how far apart and how bright the lights are. A lot of people out in the country don't want big bright lights out on their country roads. The municipality and the attorneys for the municipality are saying, gosh, you might need those because it's dangerous.
Yeah.
Another big thing is they were supposed to complete a land use map, and they haven't done that at all. So they're going to have to come back and revisit that. And one other big thing is a cottage ordinance that was included. It's the ability to have a mother-in-law unit on your property and rent it out. They say that this could help with affordable housing. They're going to allow that, but they want to do even more to allow little buildings on single lots throughout the city.
Thank you very much for that detailed update. Peter, the Obama administration and the Congress, especially the Republican leadership, continue to wrangle over gun legislation. Then suddenly, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and others have an idea that the Obama administration embraces, and the Obama administration ally Mark Begich is right there too.
There's also Democrats who are wrangling over guns in the Senate, that's for sure. But yes, this bill that Lindsey Graham and Mark Begich are the two main co-sponsors, along with Jeff Flake of Arizona and Democrat Mark Pryor of Arkansas, brought forth, I believe it was Wednesday, basically would define mental illness for those who have been adjudicated by a federal court or something like that. It would define who could or could not own a firearm. Lindsey Graham kept saying that there's 14,000 people in South Carolina who have made it through some kind of federal court system, and yet they were able to buy firearms. I asked Senator Begich about this. He doesn't know the volume in Alaska. This bill, bipartisan though it may be, is not huge. The very following day after they introduced this, the Senate Judiciary Committee brought up the assault weapons ban. That's the bill that's going to get a lot of attention. That's the most controversial one, along with magazine clips and high-capacity magazines and things like that, universal background checks. This small bill that they brought forward, probably not going to get a whole lot of opposition.
The definition of mental illness is a wide one, and people's experience with it are incredibly wide and diverse. I'm wondering here, is it just going to be a court finding that would, a ruling? Would it be a doctor's finding in a hospital examination or a psychiatrist's office? It seemed to me that there'd be some people who'd be very concerned about how this is going to work of designated people mentally ill.
There are specific definitions. It deals with people who, I mean, and there are a long list of them, but some of them are people who have pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity and things like that. People who have been involuntarily committed to psychiatric units, those types of situations. And it would be incumbent on the facility or the state to report it to this national reporting system, which already exists. Mm-hmm. It goes by the acronym NICS, and I confess I don't know what NICS stands for.
Okay, thank you. Jill, ConocoPhillips says it will not send liquefied natural gas overseas from its Nikiski plant after March 31st when its license runs out. This kind of seemed to me came from nowhere, although in the past that they had suspended it. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I don't know that it necessarily came from nowhere. We knew that, I think back as far as 2011, when it renewed its export license after purchasing the facility from Marathon Oil, that it would only seek to get yet another extension if there were available surplus of natural gas to do so. There has been a longstanding tradition of exporting LNG to Japan. That is where some of the shipments that were in this most recent time period went to from ConocoPhillips. Its license is due to expire March 31st and said it won't apply for another one. And the rationale for that is just that there are not enough available reserves, enough surplus beyond local demand to justify sending those exports overseas. It has said that it will keep its plant on standby, however, and that if that situation changes and the market condition is favorable, that they will look to proceed with doing that again sometime. So the door isn't entirely shut I think this was an expected outcome. I think this is an outcome that probably goes as an anecdotal example into the argument that the state needs to do more to spur development, to get more reserves, to kind of solve the so-called supply problem. And of course, we do have new exploration taking place with state incentives in Cook Inlet to try to find some new fields.
Okay, we're gonna have to leave it right there and finish up with Peter Granitz. Peter, we have about a minute. Fishermen, especially Alaska fishermen, are petitioning Congress and regulatory agencies to prevent genetically modified fish to enter the market, the fish market. What is a genetically modified fish, and what are the opportunities here? What is the likelihood that the Alaska fishermen and other fishermen will prevail in this argument with those who wish to manufacture these fish?
What that fish is depends upon who you ask. If you ask a commercial fisherman in Alaska, they'll probably call it a frankenfish. The FDA calls it a genetically engineered fish. A company called Aqua Bounty, based in Massachusetts, is trying to use the genome from, I believe, an Atlantic salmon and a Pacific salmon and create a hybrid fish grown on land, or effectively indoors or in pens, but they're sterile fish. They say that they won't break free into the wild, but they're huge. The public comment period on this, I believe, ends next month. And there's pushback, of course, from people who say we don't want this, you know, engineered food in our markets. But I think the criticism, it wouldn't be hard to find an Alaska fisherman who worries about what an abundance of
salmon. Speaking of time limits, our time is up. We're out of time. We'll see you next week right here on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email alaskaedition@alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests, and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.